Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Doctors change lives every day, but what happens when life changes yours? A single injury, a sudden illness, your career, your income, your future can shift in an instant. The best physicians don't just plan for success. They protect it. At Set for Life Insurance, they believe financial security isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. True own occupation disability insurance ensures that no matter what happens, your future stays in your hands. Because protecting your income means protecting everything you've built. Visit drpodcastnetwork.co/setforlife today. Secure your future before life makes that choice for you. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, we are going to answer all your questions about unions, physician unions, joining a union. Is it right for you? Let's find out. So we've got in today's episode, we've got Marissa Powell and Gabrielle Hanley, who are the lead union organizers with the Doctors Council, which is SEIU Local 10MD. Maybe we'll find out what that means, where they lead physician union campaigns and collective bargaining efforts across the country. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first, what does SEIU stand for? Because I see it all the time on our posters at work, and I see it in the hospital. What is that?
SEIU is a union that stands for Service Employees International Union. There are millions of workers around the country who are a part of doctors to attendings through Committee of Interns and Residents and attending physicians through Doctors Council, which is Local 10MD, which you referenced.
So anyone under Doctors Council is 10. MD stands for doctor. It's not like the Maryland 10th District or something.
That's right. It's the local union that happens to represent attending physicians.
Attending physicians. Okay. So let's start with what is a union? What's the legal definition of a union?
This is the answer that we tend to give people when they ask us when they're thinking about forming their own union. A union is really a group of people coming together to try to make their working conditions better through putting their weight alongside each other. Unions in the private sector are covered by the National Labor Relations Act, and you can form a union, you can do an election. In the public sector, it's a little bit different, but by and large, the process and outcome are the same. It's workers casting their lot together to try to improve their collective destiny.
So you mentioned the difference between a public union and a private union being significant. So what you're saying is some of the answers that we give today might be different if you were working in like a county hospital, right, that's state run versus a privately owned hospital.
Yes.
Does it make a difference if it's profit versus nonprofit?
So if you work for a nonprofit or a not-for-profit organization, or a for-profit one, you would still file for a union election under the National Labor Relations Board. So those might be more similar, but the public versus private would be potentially pretty different.
Pretty different. Okay. Let's just start with why physicians haven't really done this in the past. Because I, up until a couple of years ago, I had never heard of a physician union. Why was that not a thing previously?
Yeah, I'll take this one. Honestly, the big reason was because physicians owned their own practices. Doctors weren't employees. I think that's the biggest thing that has changed, obviously, over the years. I think it's about 70% or so physicians that are now employed as opposed to private. So we've seen that being like a huge difference. That said, I think there are other factors too. When you think of the word union, you obviously don't think of doctors. Maybe that's starting to change a little bit now, but ultimately, it just hasn't been a workforce that felt they had to unionize and even could legally, given the fact that a lot were private.
I think if you're in a union, then you need to be able to strike, and the logistics of striking are much more complicated for a physician than for a chicken nugget factory, right? Like, it's the patients are going to suffer, and physicians are reluctant to put their patients in that position. But now that we are, can you help us figure out who can and who can't join a union? What physicians are eligible to unionize and who are not?
Sure, that's a great question. So by and large, any physician who is employed by either a healthcare system, a hospital, a practice, they have to be an employee. That's part one. They cannot be a manager. Managers have a special test under the law that really relates to the duties that they're performing, the way that they're working. And it's really interesting working with physicians because so many wear different hats, especially in the academic setting. So we find that a big part of our initial organizing work is trying to understand who is a manager and who is not, despite the titles that people might have.
Hold on. What defines a manager? Because if you're in charge of a couple of people, if you're like a program director at a residency program, if you're a department chairperson, if you run a committee that decides who gets what OR time, like what makes someone a manager?
All of those things could. And okay. Sometimes it really comes down to what the employer argues at the time that we're going through the election process as well. And on the other side, during contract negotiations. But I think a safe way to think about it is if you have direct reports, you're almost certainly a manager. If you're a director of a lab and you're just the director of yourself, you might not be a manager. If you're a program director and you have a say over residents or you have a say over staff that help you with the residency program or the fellowship program, you might be a manager. Committees are super tricky. Some employers have fought to have certain committee memberships count as managerial, and the board has found, at least in some cases, that it has to be pretty significant oversight to rise to the level of supervisory or managerial. But the thing about physician unions and physicians in labor in general is that so many of these definitions are expanding and changing all the time. And so what exists today probably will look a little bit different down the road as well. With every new election, we get a new legal understanding of the definitions that apply to people who might seek to unionize.
With every new election
of attending physicians in particular, I think, because especially in the private sector.
Oh, someone organizes and then you need to elect someone to be in charge of that specific union. Like everyone's understanding of how this works evolves, because then there's new precedent in case law. You don't mean like a congressional election or a state election. You mean election of the union leaders.
Exactly. Not of the union leaders, but of whether or not the workforce will become unionized themselves.
Can even unionize. Okay. What's the reason that managers can't unionize? What's the rationale there?
So in the private sector, the National Labor Relations Act, particularly the Section 7 rights, give people the right to organize. And in order to be covered by those rights, you need to meet the definition of a worker, and managers don't. So it ties back to the National Labor Relations Act.
Is there anything else that we should know about who can and can't join a union?
Yes.
I was just going to say that Marissa touched on it, but the answer is always going to be, it depends. Like if you're a physician and you're interested in unionizing, like we get a lot of new contacts approach us. And this question comes up all the time. And we generally describe it as like twofold. Number one is legally, what's the definition of a supervisor? And Marissa outlined that do you have authority over people? Do you have direct reports? But then there's also the strategy end that the employer will decide. Like we've seen the same employer argue that a particular group of like assistant directors were excluded from a bargaining unit or a group that's filed for a union election. That same employer with the same attorneys argue the exact opposite for a different bargaining unit because they thought those people would be voting. Employers don't want physicians to unionize, so they're going to try any possible way. So I think that's maybe what is to add. It's like it's going to be a toss-up until we know for sure what your employer strategy will be. So we have to prepare for all of those scenarios, unfortunately.
Okay. That was going to be one of my last questions, but I think it's important to now. So if you're considering organizing in a union, who do you talk to? But it sounds like more importantly, who do you not talk to?
With any organizing effort, I think it's important to start with the people that you know and that you know well first, people who you think might share a vision of trying to make work better or elevate each other's voices. see if there's even issues that people are on the same page about, because sometimes folks are like, yeah, things could be a lot better, but that's something that's not universally felt. And it's hard to organize around issues that are not universally felt or that won't impact people. That's not to say that you can't, but I think that finding common ground across locations, across specialties, is a really important first step when you try to identify who to talk to. I think try to cast a net that's pretty representative of the workforce that you're trying to organize. You might find talking to pediatricians that there are some very specific concerns that relate to pediatricians that might not be exactly how, you know, a different specialty feels. And so there can be things that are widely felt among one specialty, but you still want to understand the issues of every way you can basically cut up the group of people that you're thinking about talking to. In terms of who not to talk to, I would say, like, probably don't just randomly call people you don't know. I think that's a good rule for everything, though.
Yeah.
Don't talk to your managers about it is what our advice would be. And honestly, like, we've noticed it's difficult, like other types of workers who we've organized in the past at other unions, other jobs. I think this is a big difference that at least I've personally seen with organizing physicians is sometimes there's a real relationship between a manager or a medical director or somebody who's in leadership, and like you might be friends with them. It might be like a really collaborative, important relationship, and you might want to tell them that you're thinking about doing this. And it's always so difficult because on the one hand, that could really destroy an effort because that person is put in a position where it could be uncomfortable for them. And if they are supportive of the effort, and we know so many administrators like are secretly supportive of this movement because of many of the same reasons, but they're not protected under the National Labor Relations Act, like Marissa was talking about. So even if you trust your higher ups, that's great, but highly recommend keeping it on the down low at first, even for their own protection as well.
Because if they were aware of it and they didn't let their own higher-ups know, they might get in trouble for not doing things that would sabotage it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's, I guess in other unions, there's a bigger, or other occupations, there's a bigger demarcation between us and them. And the them might be someone that you did residency with, and you chose to do research, and they chose to do admin, and now they're in more of a leadership position than you, and right, they become the them, which is seen less in other industries, it sounds
like. Yeah, or sometimes the them are people who are doing like 0.3 admin FTE, and then the rest of their time is clinical, and they're experiencing a lot of the same issues that the doctors who are trying to organize are. They're on the front lines in a similar way, but nonetheless, this other part of their role separates them from this kind of legal, and then I guess eventually procedural way when, you know, things kick off and it becomes known that the group is trying to unionize.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Ending Physician Overwhelm. This was one of my most popular guests from 2024. And for me, one of the most impactful episodes. We all feel overwhelmed by the demands of medicine. So Ending Physician Overwhelm by Dr. Megan Mello offers strategies to reclaim balance and joy in your life. Take the first step towards well-being. Listen and subscribe today. So you mentioned that this blurring of the lines between us and them is something that separates physician unions from other unions. Is there anything else that makes a physician union different from other unions?
I think wages are always a topic that people talk about when we think about what will unionization potentially bring if you have power and you negotiate well and you're strong with your colleagues. But for physicians where there's already a fair amount of financial security, particularly for attendings, it gives some room for people to think about how can we build collaborative structures with their employers through the collective bargaining process? How can they negotiate more room for professional judgment? For example, there's a group of urgent care physicians in Washington State, and in their contract, they negotiated language that said nothing can really interrupt the patient-physician relationship. If there's a policy from the employer that might get in the way of that relationship, the relationship supersedes by and large. And that's especially in increasingly corporatized medicine, where instead of owning your own practice, you're now an employee. I think that contractual carve-outs to hold on to autonomy and judgment in that way, fairly unique. I think also building...
That sounds like really good PR, too. Also, that language, right? If you like, oh, why are the doctors striking? They just want more money, those greedy doctors. Actually, this is the language that we want in our contract where they can't get in between me and you, the patient.
That's at the heart of it. Yeah. I think doctors are pretty aware that if you put pay us more on a sign, the general public probably would be like, I don't know about that. But
that's,
there's a lot
of one response you might get. I think that, too, there's like the different specialties, especially when we organize hospitals. We find a big difference being in any sort of workforce, there's going to be differences between this shift of workers. But when you're talking about specialties and then subspecialties within that specialty, I think one of the biggest differences that we see with physicians organizing and then also in their contracts is like they tend to get pretty granular with what they want to negotiate over because there's so many different specialties. Palliative care is going to be different from a surgeon or general surgeon. There's just going to be so many different aspects of your collective bargaining agreement, but you can still also pull from the power of everyone being together and negotiate to preserve some of the flexibility that you probably already have within your own subspecialty or not. But I do think that's a key difference, is overcoming the obstacle of people realizing that if the OBGYNs join up with the hospitalists, it doesn't mean that they're going to get the same exact pay as all the hospitalists. That's not how it works. So I think that's a big obstacle that we see and probably contributes to some of the reasons why physicians aren't unionizing, but we're really seeing that changing. And then also like post-election, when you're negotiating a contract, there's just a lot more meetings that the staffers and union members have to participate in if they want to have their voice heard and their own specialty heard. We literally have on one of our bargaining units, one palliative care guy. And like, he's got his section of the contract because it's like a small hospital and that's what it is. So yeah. I think that's a big difference too.
The dermatologists are like, listen, I know we have 11 lasers, but we really need 4 more. Right. This can't move forward unless I get 4 more lasers. You mentioned the collective bargaining. So in collective bargaining, you need leverage. And so what leverage do the physicians have? Like we mentioned striking before. Has there even been a physician strike?
There have been physician strikes. The answer used to be that they were very rare, but there have been more over the past couple of years. So there are some differences between any strike in healthcare and strike in a non-healthcare industry. You have to give 10-day notice to the employer to try to, number one, see if the strike can be called off altogether because the parties have the opportunity to come together and try to resolve whatever distance is left between them at the table. But beyond that, it's time as well for the employer to try to make plans in case there actually is a strike. So that's one thing that separates healthcare as a starting point. You know, that there have been, even within the last year or two, physician strikes of note. Like, I believe in Michigan, Team Health went on strike, just the ER people.
So what does that look like? The ER just closes?
I'll give an example. When Gabrielle and I were leading one of, I think it was the first private sector physician strike in the country's history in Washington State, it was a group of urgent cares, and the group largely announced their strike and went on strike over access to PPE during a time where the employer probably could have provided N95 masks to them and just chose not to, and also put in writing they didn't want to. You're going to end up with a really agitated workforce as a result of that when people are getting sick and dying. So they went on strike. And to your point about the good PR, like people were holding signs that said, I don't want to die at work. That was the difference. It wasn't, we want more money. We don't want to die at work. Some physicians feel very deeply that nothing, no workplace issue, no health or safety issue can get in between them and the oath that they took. So certainly some people went into work that day. The clinics continued to run. Fewer, I think only a couple of them stayed open. Some of them were totally closed. And largely the manager staffed them along with some of the people who decided to go into work anyway. And in anticipation of the strike with those 10 days, the physicians allowed their patients to have information about other urgent cares really close by they could go to instead for their care.
Yeah.
They limited the length of the strike. They said, it's going to be 2 days. This is why we're doing it. This is where we're doing it. And they did it. And
yeah.
Even though the employer said, we're never going to be able to give you what you want in this window of time, at the end of the 2 days, they received an email saying, okay, we hear you. We finally hear you. And we're going to start fit testing you and your support staff on Monday. And you all have priority placement for the vaccine. So I don't want to say that every time it plays out beautifully and you can wrap it up with a bow, but I do think that in some circumstances, and they have to be circumstances that the physicians choose for themselves, that any worker chooses for themselves, that is their right and their power. There are certainly other things they can do, but that's something physicians across the country are considering all the time.
Have there been any unions formed in a large private equity-owned practice? Because this was the last 5 years or so have seen a lot of roll-ups of practices into these larger private equity systems. And then they sell to other private equity. They get rolled up even more. And from what I'm hearing from my colleagues, people are not so happy working there. And so have we seen any unions formed within a private equity-owned system?
So we're working on it.
Okay.
As of now, as Doctors Council, we don't have a unit, that type of a unit. And I don't believe that there's other unions who have actually taken on a system quite like that. That said, the reason why I pause so much is because, you know, a lot of these not-for-profits are definitely concerning with how close they're getting with private equity and just what sort of outcome that looks like for the physicians, I think, is in question. So I guess technically no, but there are definitely people out there who are actively organizing within those types of systems. And if you are ever interested, please reach out to us.
Okay, so they can. There's no reason that they can't. They just haven't yet. And given how unhappy people are, looks like it's happening. Okay, that's interesting to know. Safety, getting between the doctor and patient relationship. What are some issues? Can we go over some things that are negotiable by a union and some things that are non-negotiable? You also mentioned just if you're a union that takes into account a multitude of specialties, it's going to be really hard to get everyone kind of pointed in the same direction, right? So that speaks to some of it. But what are some other things that are or aren't negotiable?
You can really negotiate anything if the two parties are willing to agree to it, except for like patently illegal things. But I would say that typically we see some sort of professional judgment protection, something that builds in safety mechanisms, whether it's trying to put a limit on the workflow or a minimum staffing level to try to make things a little bit safer from that perspective. I think some strong contracts have strong labor management partnerships, sometimes in the form of a doctor's council in New York City. There are thousands of physicians who are part of a collaboration council, which basically it's a forum for physicians and the highest level of management, C-suite people, to come together regularly and talk about the issues that are facing the patients and the workforce and propose quality improvement initiatives to try to fix those things, how they would be resourced and what it would actually take, and projects grow out of it. It's an open dialogue that constantly exists between management and the physicians, and it wouldn't exist, I think, in the way that it does in New York City without having been negotiated into a collective bargaining agreement. I would say other things we tend to see relate to the standard things like pay, benefits. One interesting thing that comes up a lot these days is protecting the way that people are paid. So, for example, if you're someone that loves to be production-based, you understand what it is to be production, you've built your life around figuring out what you're going to work for the year, it's very scary to think about moving to a salary model. And likewise, I talk to a lot of proceduralists who are like, I like being salary. I don't want to think about having to do more surgeries if they move me to production and potentially having what I might earn mixed in with my professional judgment. So protections like that, I think, are important to build in as well. So it really depends on the group. It really depends on the specialty, on the person, on what people want to fight for.
And some things that you can't negotiate over, like technically, there are permissive subjects to bargaining, which basically you couldn't have a proposal that's, okay, we want to fire the CEO, or we want to, this clinic must hire like 8 new nurses or something like that. But there's a lot you can still do to influence staffing and how operations run at your hospital or your clinic if you organize together. And one of those things could be actually negotiating for things that might incentivize your employer to hire more nurses or to retain more nurses. But it also could be like straight up organizing outside of the bargaining table. Like, for example, even talking to the media and being like coordinated and organized, like we've seen at Allina Healthcare, for example, we have a bargaining unit out there that's about 600. It's APPs and physicians, primary care. And they coordinated together and they basically whistle blew and they got a policy that fired patients for having a certain amount of medical debt and the children of those patients. They totally got that policy removed because of the public shaming that they were able to do through their contacts at the New York Times. Like, it was huge. So that happened before they even started negotiating. So it's just, there's a lot more. I would say that a lot of physicians are like, I talked to my friend who's a lawyer and he said that we can't really technically negotiate over this and technically that. There are limitations for sure, but there is a lot you can do through organizing itself.
So it sounds like you could also leverage the dirt that you've got on them. Yeah, make them look bad. Okay, that's a great bargaining tool. So you don't even have to strike. If you're like, listen, I'll air your dirty laundry. Great idea. So is there any difference between organizing attendings and residents? Like, what's the difference there?
I would say that one of the bigger differences is the potential under certain labor law precedent for residents to be ruled as students. It just doesn't exist the same way for attendings.
We're lifelong learners, though. Marissa,
yeah, I think that's a beautiful thing, but it might preclude you from forming a union.
Oh, no, I'm glad.
Yeah, but I know we talked at the beginning about some of the differences between physicians and really any other kind of worker, but I do think that when it comes down to it, people just want a voice. Maybe what that voice looks like is different from industry to industry or job to job or training to being an attending, but the voice element to be, you know, there was a really great organizer, Gabi, and I used to work with, who said you should never bargain over respect. You should never ask for respect at the table. That's not even something that you should care about. And I agree with that. But at least not just having a voice, but having a voice that has to be heard is very important, because lots of systems say, come to our listening sessions and we'll hear you and whatever. But if it doesn't go anywhere, then you could spend that time probably doing literally anything else.
Yes. Although the airing of the grievances does sometimes feel good, but it doesn't feel so good afterwards when it doesn't get you anywhere. If there's a listener who is considering starting a union, what's the critical mass that you would want them to know about before, like, they can pull the trigger on something like that?
I encourage people to reach out if they even have a few people interested, because reaching out to a union to help you organize is important. But in terms of, if you're asking about actually filing for a union election, is that kind of what the question is? Like, how do you actually get there?
Like, they're like talking to a couple of their colleagues and they're disgruntled. And like, yeah, I've friends who did this in another city and I think we should start a union, but we're a hospital of 250 physicians and this is just 4 of us. At what point are you like, all right, there are enough of us, we should reach out to the doctors' council?
I think it's a little bit less about how many and dependent on like how many specialties might be interested. And it's hard to break out of your own specialty, like I know, but I think that's really a big indicator. If you can figure out what other specialists care about and actually break out of your own department, that's a big indicator to give us a call and be like, hey, we're serious about this. And also, like, folks who know that there are multiple issues, like, it's not just asking yourself, is this really just about the compensation change that they made for the hospitalists only? or is this something deeper? And it tends to be something deeper.
Oh, yeah.
Almost all the time. Everyone we talk to seems to be like looking for another job at all points. And we're like, we're probably going to be talking at any place you land. But I think that having multiple specialties interested or open to the idea tends to be a really good indicator. And then we talk about, okay, what does the group actually look like? And then we have a million more questions for you beyond that.
Got it. So first step would be reach across specialties, see if there's interest among other specialties than yours, and then take the next step would be reaching out to you. So if they want to get in touch with the Doctors Council, where do we find you?
Doctorscouncil.org is a really good place to start. But I think this is something that we like to tell people is it really doesn't matter what union you end up going with. The best union in the world doesn't mean very much if there isn't militancy among the people who are organized as a part of that union. So reach out to us or reach out to someone who's in your city or just start talking to your colleagues and see how far it can go. But be prepared to have work to do basically for as long as you have a union. It doesn't start and end with the election. I would say that the hard stuff begins after the election's over and you're trying to get to the table with your employer. It's hard, but I think it's better than doing nothing at all.
Great. More stuff to do. Marissa Powell and Gabrielle Hanley of the Doctors Council. Again, that's doctorscouncil.org. Thank you so much for your time and all you do for physicians.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review. Something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you. This is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice, or financial advice, or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.